This is Tom Heck with the Manager as Coach Boot Camp. Today is August 25th, 2008. It is 1:03 p.m. Eastern, and this is a special bonus call today. On the line with us is Barry Relaford, who works with Stephen Covey, Stephen M.R. Covey, and at the Covey Link organization, which we're going to learn more about in a moment. We're going to be talking about trust and exploring trust today. And to give you a little background on Barry, he is I've known Barry for a number of years. I'm delighted to say that we're friends. And Barry is a real honest-to-goodness globetrotter. He, depending on the day, I could email him, and he could be in any number of countries and leading training events and working with people on trust and on the area of trust and this this piece on how do we build trust and expand trust and how do we build an organization based on trust. He has absolutely got a gift for presenting complex content in an understandable, memorable, and here's the key, an actionable manner. And I had mentioned this right before we hit the recording today, that a lot of people understand the value of trust, and if you talk to anybody about trust, they say, oh, trust is very important in our organization, and yet how do we actually make it actionable? So there's this great book, The Speed of Trust by Stephen M.R. Covey, been a bestseller in the business environment, and I think it's a must-read for anyone who's listening to this call. And how do we put this into action? Barry is regularly speaks and trains internationally. He's led programs in 15 countries, probably more by now, and has had participants from over 50 different nations. His clients have included Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, Honeywell, Toyota, Nike, the U.S. Army, and he's got an extensive background in personal and leadership development as a coach, a facilitator, and a leader with multiple organizations. And so, Barry, I want to welcome you to the call.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad my agent sent such a great intro.
Well, it's you know, it's funny to be introduced, and you've got the credentials, and it's and I'm not even reading all of them, so it's great to have you on the call. And I'm really excited also for the people who are people who are listening to this and are going to be able to ask you questions about application of this in this area of trust. So what I want to do first is create a foundation. If folks are new to this concept, the speed of trust, if you can give us sort of a brief background on why, maybe we should start with the book. Why do you think the book has been so popular?
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, certainly the Covey brand is a great brand. Stephen R. Covey, who authored The Seven Habits, is you know, is a very well-known and trusted brand in himself. And so I think the Covey name certainly gets people's attention. That's helped us get liftoff. But I think the topic of trust is one that people look at and say, like we were talking before we got on this call, is that it's pretty obvious to people. You know, most people don't argue with the concept of trust. Mm-hmm. They go, yeah, it's, you know, pretty obvious. But what we say is that what we're doing is taking what most people consider a soft social virtue and showing that it's a hard economic driver, that literally as you look at your organization, whether it be a business or a nonprofit or school or whatever you work in, is that you've got some type of economic component, some way that you're funding your organization, and if you ignore trust, it's to your peril. It's going to cost you, literally.
Mm-hmm. And you, in the book, there's an equation that you talk about that kind of outlines the hidden cost of ignoring trust. Can you describe that?
Yeah, it's a simple, in business school, you often learn a formula like this that is that strategy times execution equals results. Or in other words, you know, come up with a good strategy, execute well on it, and you'll get good results. Mm-hmm. What we call the hidden or ignored variable is trust, and that it factors both your strategy and your execution, and that organizations ignore it. You know, just don't. People go, oh, you know, trust. Yeah, good idea. I'm not going to argue with it. But we got more important things to do here. You know, we got to go get our strategy together. We've got to, you know, we got to just do stuff. And the challenge is if people don't think about what impact does this have on the overall trust accounts with our different stakeholder groups, it's going to cost us. In fact, our definition of leadership is it's getting results in ways that inspire trust with all stakeholders. And so that formula, as simple as it sounds, is actually quite profound and helps generate what we call either a trust tax or a trust dividend.
Okay, so as you now, in your role with CoveyLink, can you describe your role with the organization?
Yes, I do a variety of things. Most of what I've been involved with Stephen, actually Stephen was a coaching client I had, and I got more involved than I expected. But I started working with Stephen about 4.5 years ago, and he had a speech to give at the National ASTD conference. And he called me up one day. We didn't know each other very well. We'd known each other from Franklin Covey, where we both worked. They called me up and said, "Hey, Barry, I've got this speech, and they want my slides." And I said, "Oh, you need some help with PowerPoint?" And he said, "No, I don't have a speech." And I said, "Well, you can't speak at ASTD without a speech topic." And he said, "What?" I said, "What's the topic?" He said, "It's the speed of trust." I said, "Ooh, that's intriguing." We got together, and he had a lot of ideas. This is actually something he'd been working on for many, many years, back to the time when he was running Covey Leadership Center before the merger with Franklin. But as we sat down and really looked at it, so my first role was helping Stephen get clarity around his ideas, helping him get ready for that first speech. And then since then, it's been helping develop, help contribute to the book, and then put all the training materials together. And now I do a lot of the delivery and the train the trainer, et cetera. So mm-hmm. I'm a co-founder and partner, but it's really been much more on how do you take these ideas and make them work inside of organizations.
So what are the key ideas then that as you go around to organizations and they say, "Well, we like the speed of trust, come and teach us how to do this," what have you learned from a training perspective and going to see all these different organizations that understand the importance but don't know how to make it happen?
Well, one thing I would say just for a moment, people think they understand the importance, but they really don't. If Stephen were on the phone instead of me, he would probably say something like, he said this a number of times, we'd be sitting in a conversation, he said, "Boy, if people really understood this, they would behave differently." So even if people have read the book, they still think, you know, oh yeah, it's getting into literally where you translate idea into action or move it from good concept into habit, where you don't think about it, where it becomes your new norm, the new way you operate. That takes some time, and generally even a couple of days of training is not necessarily going to shift that or reading the book. So mm-hmm. some things I've seen work are not necessarily unique to CoveyLink or our work at Speed of Trust, but they work in other types of programming, whether an individual or an organization is looking to adopt new behavior. And so one of the key things is everybody understanding what's the necessity of this, why Speed of Trust versus so many other good things out there. And part of my background is as a language instructor. I used to teach French at a language immersion school. And one of the things you learn is that there's a reason you're learning the language. Most of the people I trained were North Americans who were going to Europe for a couple of years. And so helping them, and so it wasn't about learning the language. It was learning the language so they could do what they were there to do. And the same thing with training, even team building, is that, so why are we building a team? Why are we learning about trust? Well, so that we can get better results with one another. More efficiently, more effectively, and results aren't just economic. They're also be more fulfilled and be who we want to be at work. So first thing I think is understand what's the necessity, particularly economically. Second is being able to look at how do we get a shared language and the speed of trust. As you know, Tom, we've got a lot of numbers in there. We've got, you know, five waves of trust, starting with self-trust, going all the way out to societal trust. We've got four cores of credibility, which is about yourself. How do you give people someone to trust? And then there are 13 behaviors of high trust. And so helping people get a common language, I think, is a second step. And then the third is really all kinds of different ways that you reinforce that through behavior and other types of systemic things. And that's in the third wave that we call organizational trust. But it's literally aligning your systems, your processes, your structure with one of the key thoughts being how does this system affect trust, or how does trust affect this system, maybe a better way to put it.
So when you start to present this information within an organization, do people start to glaze over? I'm guessing
not if I'm doing my job right. No. I save that. You can glaze later. No, literally, as a facilitator, our job, and hopefully one of my gifts, is around engaging people. So again, intellectually, people usually don't have an issue with this. They go, you know, either they think, you know, it's important, I get that intellectually, or I'm already good at this. And so oftentimes how we'll start off is helping people go through some kind of experiential activity that gets them into finding where they say, oh, I understand this, but then you put them in a behavioral situation, they go, oh, maybe I don't. You know, I got it in my head, but I don't really have it in my body. Mm-hmm. It's not, I'm not completely into this yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use a variety of exercises, depending on the amount of time we've got,
right,
to get people into a more open state. And then from there we start to say, you know, we understand it, its importance, but what are we really talking about? And literally even the definition of trust is something we need to get to level set around for people.
So what is the biggest misconception that you find about trust?
I think one of them, I don't know if the biggest, I mean, one big one is that people equate trust with character. In other words, if you're a good person, you should be trusted. And yet we've all had the experience with someone that we've worked with or sought a service from, you know, we're going into a retail or something, and we deal with a nice person, they're a good person, there's nothing wrong with their integrity or their intent,
mm-hmm,
but they're not competent. And so when we talk about, at CoveyLink, when we talk about trust, it's not just are you a good person, it's also can you get the job done that you need to be able to do. So I think that's one of the big misconceptions I see. Even if I'm spending a couple of days with a group, on the second day I'll keep pointing out to people, you know what, you're telling me this, but I hear you still speaking from the paradigm of, well, trust is all about being a good person. And I'll say, it absolutely includes that, but do not ignore competence.
How do you see this play out in an organization? Can you give us an example of why this is an important distinction to understand?
Well, literally, you'll have people who... and again, it depends on the type of organization. We see it more prevalent than others because there's an opposite problem where people believe competence is all that matters and how you get results doesn't. And we're saying, hey, look, it's not an either-or. If you want to have sustainable trust, sustainable results, you've got to have both character and competence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to think of a specific example here, Tom. I'm not one's jumping out at me, but I'll hear this is the common kind of comment I'll hear from people, and it's something like, you know, I think our organization expects too much, or people are too demanding, or there's, you know, all we seem to care about here is money, 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 and it's not about what kind of work you do or how good of a person you are. They won't say it in quite those words, but you hear that belief showing up. And part of it's, and when people are talking about, well, if you're having a hard time with this person, well, it's not that I don't trust them. I'll say, yeah, but so why don't you, and a word we use interchangeably is confidence. So why don't you have confidence? Why do you check up on their work and micromanage them? Why do you make sure that, you know, you do explicit agreements, you keep all your email trails, you do blind copies? Why is that all about? Well, I just don't know they're going to get it done. And why is that? Well, because they haven't in the past. Okay, we could call that a lack of trust or a lack of confidence.
Hmm. And you and I have spoken in the past about the emotional charge around the topic of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that? I mean, when you go in and work with people, how often is it that emotion gets caught up in this topic?
Actually, it's a lot, because for people, most of this trust has a connotation, not a denotation, but a connotation of really getting into things like integrity. So if I say, I don't trust you,
mm-hmm,
most of us take that as an affront personally, and understandably. It's like you're either doubting my integrity, who I fundamentally am as a person,
mm-hmm,
or my intent. And then I'm out for myself only. And so when we talk about, you know, so again, this is where people feel like, I got it, I understand it, I can be trusted, it's the other people around me that have a problem. And so one of the tools we use is, you're probably aware, is a 360 feedback tool where people, and depending if we're working with an intact work team or if we're working more generally in an organization, but people will get feedback, both that they give themselves, they often get from their person they report to, as well as peers, and then direct reports that they've got them. And that can be a really challenging thing for some folks, where they're starting to see as they're seen, and to reconcile their own views of how they see themselves and how others see them, both on a character and competence standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so that's one of the things we try to do to help. Again, part of this is help raise it to the surface where people say, okay, this is a bigger, it's different than what I thought it was. It is important, but then it moves into things, so what do we do about it? How do we start to earn what we call the dividends of trust versus keep paying trust taxes?
Very good. For our listeners, the folks on this call, participants in the Manager as Coach program, If you've got a question for Barry, just hit your star 6 key to unmute yourself and at any point during the call, and I can generally see if technology is working the way it should, that you have unmuted yourself and you've got a question. Does anybody have a question at this time?
This is Ethan.
Yes, Ethan.
Hi, Ethan.
Hi. I have a question. Last week I called upon the group to help coach me into managing up situation and was able to use that and address that with the CEO, and I'm meeting with the VPs, met with one last week, meeting with another one this week, and then taking that on to the leadership team. One of the individuals I'm going to meet with seems to become very emotionally charged when confronted with decisions and issues that he has created by choosing to operate more in a bubble. How do I go about addressing these issues and how they affect the rest of the organization and keep the emotional level low when we have not yet implemented 360 degrees here? I have created the forms, but we have not started using them yet.
Okay. Let me make sure, this is Barry, let me make sure I understand here, Ethan, is that you've got a leadership team you're working with, and that one of these individuals, you're finding that when you work with him or her that they operate in a bubble. Am I getting that right?
Yes.
Tell me what you mean by that. What do you mean they're operating in a bubble?
Well, this individual is responsible for quite a variety of projects in the organization. But often they will make independent decisions without consulting with other members of the leadership team or members of the departments that are going to be affected by the choices that they make. Looking at the choice, it often makes sense if you look at just the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the outcome, there could have been other more viable options that would have more readily fit the desired outcome. And so whenever this individual makes those decisions, if you question them, the individual becomes defensive and passionate, yet unwilling to listen to other viewpoints.
Mm-hmm. One of the general things, I've got two or three different thoughts here, Ethan. I'm not sure. Well, I'll just start with a couple things, see if this is helpful. One of the 13 behaviors that I referenced is listen first. And listening is more than just with our ears. It's truly with our eyes and with our heart, really helping create a space that a person can speak into is the way I think about this, listening space. In order to do that ourselves, we need to quiet ourselves. So one of the things we work on is our own credibility. Can I give to another person someone they can trust? Can I give to them someone they can be safe with? And again, I'm not saying that they have to bare their soul to me. That's their call. But at least for what pertains to the work we're doing together, can I create a space where they can share what their thinking is, or at least how they're feeling about things? And we can do it in a way that emotion's not a bad thing in my mind. An emotional charge, even if a person fires up a bit, gets angry or upset, or sometimes they just need that listened out of them in a way. And if I can create that space where they feel safe and they can explore that, they're not going to do that with someone they don't trust. So first of all, I got to work on me. But if I can create that space, listening and acknowledging, there's a lot more about effective listening skills and empathic listening. In fact, the 7 habits is one thing I look toward for that. What could happen is helping a person hear themselves and talk through what they really want. That's one of the things I like to explore with people. So I hear so-and-so, you're making this decision, and maybe not even a specific decision, but even talking about the pattern of decisions they're making and saying, let's talk about what you really want out of this, and let's talk about the consequences or outcomes of the choices you made, not just for you, but also on the other members of the team and their acceptance or input or the person you report to or other departments that report into you, et cetera. And I know I'm speaking kind of generally, Ethan. Is this helpful at all?
Well, it is, because this is the direction I was going anyway. But
mm-hmm. Good. So I gave you the right answer. As long
it clarifies my thought processes, because that's actually what I have on my paper. So that works well.
And one of the things genuinely that I find, and this sounds a little surprising to people on some levels, But is that we talk about five waves of trust, and the first wave is self-trust. It's literally, can I trust myself, and can I give to other people someone they can trust? I can't control whether people trust me. That's their choice. What I can do, though, is control whether I give them someone they can trust. And so how I behave, or my fundamental stance, the emotional energy I'm carrying with me, how safe I can make it, those, and we talk about four cores of credibility in more depth, but do I have both the skill level, the competence, results, track record, but also the intent and integrity that a person can feel safe and say, you know what, here's what's really going on for me. And it's usually not in one interaction. It can be over a period of time where they start feeling, you know what, okay, here's what's really going on. It's like, okay, and I need to be able to be a faithful translator of that, to play back to them what they're saying, and then they can probably solve much of this on their own.
Very good. Thank you, Barry.
Barry, how often is it that leaders think that trust is about somebody else?
Oh, boy. And not just all of us. We're all leaders. There's something Stephen R. Covey says, is that when you think that the problem is out there, it's other people, that very thought is the problem. Very commonly. I mean, oftentimes we'll get commissioned or invited in by a senior leader who says, you know, our organization has challenges with trust, and it's kind of like, I need you to come in and fix everybody. And they will go to training, they will get fixed, they will, you know, it's like getting sent to camp. And again, nothing wrong with that. The challenge can be, you know, each of us contributes to things being the way they are. Just a quick little story on that. I worked at CompuServe early in my career, and I was in graduate school at the same time at night studying organizational design and other stuff, and one of my professors said that line, each of us contributes to things being the way they are. And I remember having this thought, boy, CompuServe's a better place because I work there. You know. And even if that's the truth, even if everything I did made the company a better place, I was still dissatisfied with stuff that was going on in the organization, especially culturally, and thought, well, if culture isn't what I want it to be, this way of operating with one another, what am I not doing? Assuming everything I'm doing is helpful, there may be some things I'm not doing that if I were to do those can make things better. Mm-hmm. And that thought really stunned me. It was one that literally changed my behavior. After that, I took more risks. I got involved in other types of projects it was like, you know, maybe I'm not sharing all the talent or passion or things. I'm excusing my behavior based on the choices of others versus contributing in quite a way I can. So I think for all of us, it's that whatever state your organization's in, we are contributing to that, hopefully positively, but sometimes we're not doing all we could, or sometimes we're doing some things that are making it hard on other people.
And by the way, if you do, one of our listeners does have a question, just go ahead and unmute yourself, and I'll be able to see it on this end. We'll take a moment here. Have we raised any other issues that people want to ask Barry help on directly? Okay. Well, there's a couple questions. We've got managers on this call who are at different levels within the organization. How you've gone in, and you just mentioned this, where a CEO perhaps, someone that's very high in the organization says, we want you to come in, Barry, and help us with this trust issue. And then you can work on the trust in an organizational capacity, I mean, organization-wide, I should say. And then there are situations where someone on this very call might be reading your book and saying, you know, how much change can I bring about within an organization? It's just me reading the book, The Speed of Trust. And what do you say in that situation to someone who's just, you know, reading the book, and yet they want to change the culture of their team, which maybe they have influence on, but then there's this whole other level or levels above them who are influencing and impacting everybody beneath them, including the manager.
Okay, let me make sure I understand the question then, Tom.
Okay.
So you're saying if I'm, say, a middle manager, I've got levels above me, maybe there's at least some level reporting into me, and I get a hold of this concept or read this book on the speed of trust, what can I do when I'm not the most senior leader in the organization?
Right. The senior leader being, assuming the senior leader has the most power to influence everybody and change a culture, because if I start to change, try to impact some of the people with what you're teaching, I might run into resistance from the rest of the organization that's not designed to support what you're teaching.
Gotcha. So, and actually there's a couple of the most senior leaders, and I work with them, and sometimes they're small organizations. I've worked with organizations as small as 14, 15 people, and some as large as, oh, they probably have 160, 170,000 employees. So, and in those, I haven't, I think the largest organization I've worked with, I've worked with the most senior team, probably had about 80,000 people or something. So a pretty good-sized organization. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, some of these most senior leaders feel like they can't bring about as much change as they would like. You know,
really?
Like, boy, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll come back to that. Let me answer your first question.
Okay.
So I'm a frontline supervisor, middle manager, et cetera. I'm not the most senior person in my division or whatever, and there's people above me. And what can I do? I don't even have to be a manager to help bring about change in terms of the trust level in an organization, because literally we use this metaphor of like dropping a rock into a pond, a still pond. When you drop that rock in, it starts ripples, or if it's big enough, it'll even create waves. Is that each of us, by the choices that we make on a daily basis, can, and going to your term of emotional charging, we can make we influence that. We may think, well, I'm not the big charge. I'm not the one in charge, but we all charge. And so, being able to see ourselves that way and to conduct ourselves that way, where literally everything I do, if I look at every interaction I have through the lens of trust, in a sense, if I put on these trust glasses, one of the metaphors you use based on a story Stephen tells, is that if I look at every interaction through the lens of trust, and it can be as simple as when I make a commitment to people, I keep it. So I'm careful in my commitments, not saying I don't make them, but I'm careful. I'm not just telling people what I think they want to hear or trying to please them. I really want to help, I do what I say I'm going to do. That increases trust. And if I'm doing that on behalf of my team, I'm thinking about the capabilities of my team, and, you know, we're a staff function or we could be a line function, whatever we are, but we keep our commitments. And so we deliver on our results. What happens is that our stakeholders, people around us, other departments, person we report into, tend to have greater confidence in us. We say, boy, when I turn this over to Tom's group, they do what they say they're going to do, and they do it with excellence. They perform. You know, that gives us confidence. And if the way in which they work is they're easy to work with. You know, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, pleasers, but it's been going like, boy, these guys, they get it, they move fast, they accomplish things, and when I watch them work together, they do it at a high degree of trust. Wow, that's impressive. In fact, you tend to get more work, which is kind of crazy. We feel like, boy, you know, I'm just going to get more stuff, but we tend to depend on those we have confidence in. And our work tends to get a little less questioning over time. That will depend on the person we report into or upstream or downstream clients. But it's being able to say, literally, it starts with, if it's me as a team leader, it's how, and I've done this inside of organizations, fairly large ones, where I've said, you know what, there's thrash all around us, there's confusion, there's chaos, we don't have the clarity we'd like. At least for the work we're doing, we are going to have clarity, we're going to have trust, and I'm not demanding it, I'm modeling it, inviting it, and seeking to be that as a leader. From there, what can happen is that literally a lot of the training we do is not with the most senior levels of organizations. We'll start within a division or a department, and it kind of can roll out from there to be viral within the rest of the organization. So to me, it's not just about trust. It's really any organizational change we're trying to bring about. It starts with us. And are we giving people someone who models the behavior we're espousing that's in alignment, hopefully, with the organization's values? And again, it's as simple as making and keeping commitments to people. So
you mentioned a second ago mandating trust. Have you seen what's the way not to work on this issue that you've seen people read the book and they say, okay, we're going to do this now. Everybody must trust each other.
Yeah, well, and again, I'm comparing this to quality to any other major cultural initiative like this, is that, it's so hard to mandate these things. You got to model it. And so what really arms this, I call it arming the cynics, but when we say one thing and we behave in a different way, so we all say, we're going to have a high-trust culture, mm-hmm. and yet we behave in ways that signal to people we don't trust you, or we don't trust ourselves fundamentally, mm-hmm. that is just, it arms the cynics. People in a low-trust environment, you must be so careful about what you say. In fact, I don't know if you've been in companies or organizations that when you walk into their meeting rooms, they have ground rules, you know, kind of like here, and some of it's keep the room clean stuff. There's others about listener respect and acknowledge comments, these kind of things. I think in some organizations, in the spirit of full disclosure, they ought to put the Miranda rights up there. Everything you say can and will be used against you, you know, because
right.
it's like that. And we walk in, and what people find in a low-trust environment or no-trust environment, everything you say can and will be used against you. And so people tend not to volunteer their best work. They don't give their greatest passion. They check their best ideas and things at the door because they say, gosh, I don't want this used against me. I don't want to be, you know, ridiculed or, you know, poo-pooed or whatever the negative behavior is. So I think being able to help – sorry, I lost train of thought there.
Well, we were talking about mandating. And,
yeah,
and
sorry,
so
thank you.
You would never suggest to an organization that they mandate that we're going to do this? Or, I mean, you've got a mandate that they've show up at the training. Right, the speed of trust training. Oh, I think we might have lost Barry. Well, while Barry dials us back, it looks like he's going to be dialing in here in a second. Are there any questions for Barry while he's, or have we raised issues for anybody? It looks like we just dropped them around trust.
Hey, Tom, this is Deborah.
Yes, Deborah.
I'd like to hear him talk to us about the difference between trust and integrity. I heard him say that trust is about competence, but I'm having trouble separating the two.
So the difference between trust and integrity.
Yeah.
Okay. Barry, are you back?
Tom, that was Joyous who beat them.
Okay, there we go. So trust and integrity.
I think from the model on the website, they've got the two components of our character and competence. And I wouldn't mind if he would talk more about the difference between the two, particularly the competence piece.
Okay, so the character and competence and trust and integrity. So, Deborah, for you, that's you want to be able to speak to the difference between those two.
Right. And it's along the same lines of what Julia said, because he said people equate character and trust, and he said character is about being a good person. Trust is about your competence. And then later on he talked about integrity and intent. And I'm just, you know, if somebody's not trustworthy, does that mean they don't have integrity?
If they're not, say that one more time, Deborah.
If you don't trust them, I'd just like to hear what the difference is between not trusting them and or trust in them having integrity. If you can't trust them, do they have integrity? I don't know.
Okay, it's a good point. So if you were to say to a coworker, I don't trust you, what are you also saying when it comes to saying, do you have integrity? Sort of behind the lines there. And Julius, I'm hoping that, Barry, have you come back online?
You may have to take us all off mute.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do that. You might have, let's see this. I'm going to take
us.
Here we go. Barry, are you back?
I'm still here.
Are you still here? Okay,
yeah.
Very good. So I'm wondering if you can speak to the issues that Deborah brings up and Julius brings up. One, and both of them are.
I think I got that, Tom.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I heard that. And if I don't get it exactly, back me up, and I'm glad to do it.
Okay. And by the way, it looks like Barry, you might have come back in and not. Did you fall out from the recording?
I thought it was recording again and asked me for permission to do that.
Okay. It looks like you're not a moderator, so that means that if you're not on mute right now, could you put yourself on mute by hitting your star 6 key? Not Barry, but everybody else. So, because Barry, I can't, at this point I'm not able to mute everybody and just have us on the line. So
okay.
You got those pieces about trust and integrity and what Julius brought up about character and competence.
Yeah, so let me see if this would be helpful to everybody. And I'm sorry, I'm referencing some things in the book. I'm not sure what level of understanding people have. We talk about five ways of trust, and the first one is called self-trust. And we use the word trust interchangeably with confidence. So you could say self-confidence. So we look at, and to use Deborah's word, trustworthy, is somebody trustworthy? In other words, are they worthy of trust? Do they merit trust? Is fundamentally our credibility. Are we credible? Are we believable? So we have what we call the four cores of credibility. And what may help you, if you just want to draw this with me, if you've got something to draw with, this may just help you see visually what I'm talking about. So if you draw a tree, and a tree has both a part above the ground and a part below the ground. A lot of times when we think about a tree, we only think of the part that we normally see. But below the ground, for a healthy tree, it's got a root system. So we talk about, as Julius mentioned, there's both a character aspect, which we display as kind of being below the ground. It's not something that we tend to see as apparently. And then the competence part is the part above the ground. And then these four cores line up with this. So the deepest part of a person, and we could call this the root system, is a person's integrity. And we define that as being, yes, it includes honesty, deep honesty, but integrity has the same root as the word integer, which is a whole number, or integrated. There's a wholeness. People with integrity are integrated with principles. They have, you know, they're really clear on who they are, what they stand for, what they say, what they believe, what they think. There's a congruency there. And while we're all working on that, it's still, you get that sense of people that we can trust, that are trustworthy or credible, is that they have integrity. There's a sense of this person's solid. They've got a strong root system. Coming up from that, if we lay out these four cores on our tree, that the bottom of the page, or whatever I'm drawing, the bottom of the tree, I draw integrity. Then just below where I've got my ground there, maybe my line dividing the bottom from the top, I put intent. We use the word intent to describe, in business terms, kind of your motivation or your agenda. And the agenda that reduces trust is a hidden one, where people don't know where we're coming from. We look good on the outside, we sound good, but fundamentally our deeper wisdom says, be careful, watch out. It feels or we sense there's something else going on here. And so we believe that the agenda that increases trust is that I want you to win too. It's not just that I want to win, I want to succeed, I want you to win too. And we probably all know people that we sense, you know what, I love working with these people because I sense they don't have a hidden agenda, I know what they want, and it's very aligned with what I want, they're easy to work with. So those two first cores, as we call them, tie into character. The next two, so if the intent's kind of like the trunk of our tree and it goes down into the roots, especially the tap root, is we look at the leaves and branches of the tree, and that we call capabilities. This is normally what people think about as competence, but we think about capabilities and use an acronym, TASKS, or TASKS, and it stands for talents, what are those things you're naturally gifted at, attitudes, how do you tend to see the world, your skills, what can you do, your knowledge, what do you know, and then finally your style, what's your unique way of doing things. And in order to, people that we trust, they've well matched their tasks, this capital TASKS, to the tasks that need to be done. And then finally, the fourth core is what we call results. And on the tree, it might be the nuts or the fruit or whatever we harvest from this tree. That results are really what bias credibility, in a sense, and bias maybe is not the right verb, but it's what really earns this credibility where people say, hey, it's not just I believe this person has integrity, I trust their intent, they have the capabilities, but then they deliver. So in our model and in our world, it's not an either-or. It's not that I want somebody who has character and not competence, or that I want somebody who's got competence and not character. What we're looking at is a wholeness here, a healthy tree, in a sense, that's going to be enduring. It's going to put out fruit. It's going to hold the soil in place. It's, you know, we can trust this. It's solid. And the same way on our teams and in our organizations, we're looking to create, to both attract and create an environment where people can really thrive and be healthy with one another. So,
Barry, let me see if I have this right. So in your model of the tree, there's if we draw a horizontal line which represents the ground, the tree that we see is above the ground, the root system are below. Mm-hmm. Everything above ground is referred to as competence.
Mm-hmm.
Everything below ground is referred to as character. And character has one area that you talk about, which is integrity.
Actually,
right?
Two areas, Tom.
I'm sorry, integrity and what else?
And intent.
Intent. Okay, I thought intent was above ground.
It kind of both. And the more we declare our intent, the clearer it is.
I see. Okay. So
it's when it's totally hidden is it tends to reduce trust.
I see. So intent is sort of in that mid-ground there, mm-hmm. and then as we move up the tree above ground there, we have capabilities, and then results are the fruit of all of this work.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if we start to if someone's integrity starts to diminish, obviously the tree is going to get sick and not produce as much fruit. With the metaphor, the results are going to diminish.
Yeah, I mean, if we take the outcomes, as I understand them, of this program, Manager as Coach, mm-hmm. so we're looking and saying, you know, we certainly want to strengthen people in their integrity. You know, that a person's chosen to be in a managerial role, there's a way of showing up as who we are as people that mm-hmm. we want to sense one another. And then our intent would be, hey, as a manager, I'm not just here to get my needs met or to rule over people or do infernal things to them. It's that I really want to create an environment where people, you know, this is the best place they've ever worked. I'm helping create that environment as a leader. That I have the right capabilities or I'm developing them through programs like this. And that fundamentally what my organization's funding my role and or my participation in this program is to be able to produce better results through our teams, through what we're seeking to create here as an organization.
So Deborah's question was around trust and integrity of the relationship, and Julia's was around character and competence. At the beginning of this recording, you talked about one of the things that you get out of having a training or people studying this is a common language, mm-hmm. that people aren't confused any longer about intent and integrity and character and competence. Is that one of the benefits of...
That's one of the benefits of the desired outcomes. I mean, sometimes people are still confused, but yeah. There's only so much we can do about that. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Deborah, Julius, do you have any question about what Barry said? Or is that clear?
Well, the other question I would have is I went online and there's a survey tool online that's pretty interesting. And clearly, like any test, 100 is ideal. But I'm wondering where on those scales problems start cropping up. Assuming you can be anything from a 0 to 100.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there are, I mean, problems can start in any area, Julius, and I haven't looked at the questionnaire in a little while to know. I use a different tool when I'm working with organizations. Does it have 9 questions in it? Is that the one I'm thinking of?
It's 8 or 9, yeah.
Okay. Which is fairly... you know, that's a real quick look. Normally we have ones that go into much greater depth that we use in organizations. And so your question was about, do we see particular areas where things crop up? Is that right?
Well, it's basically on the 0 to 100 scale, kind of what's, assuming you're striving for 100, what's a good score?
A good score is going to be the one that helps you get consistent results with your stakeholders. How's that for a... we don't have cutoff scores. This is really more of a temperature-taking, kind of intriguing type of thing. I don't even know how much, and I don't mean to sound disparaging, because anything, it's interesting, when people ask us about our surveying and stuff, you know, are all these questions vetted, and, you know, we've had psychometricians go through them, et cetera. When we ask other people about trust, you know, people say, well, how reliable is this? And I say, well, if these are people you need to work with and have their confidence and have confidence in them, but if they're giving you feedback, you'd certainly want to get a sense of how they see you. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's valid. And that's, in some respects, most valid. How predictable it is, good question. You know, that's the thing of that particular instrument's not heavily designed for that thing. 9 questions isn't probably enough to get at that. But a good, you know, what's a good score? I think there's some scale on there. Again, I haven't looked at that one in a while. But... to me, I'd always want to be striving for 100, not because it's necessarily achievable, but it's that, to me, the organizing thought is, how do I build trust with everybody with whom I'm interacting? Recognizing there's days I make mistakes, days I'm not as focused, that people have their own choices, we're getting influenced by things outside of our control, and yet in a high-trust environment, we're able to work through that in a whole different way than when it's a low or no-trust environment.
I would also assume that it's probably a good thing if your picture of yourself matches up with what people see in you.
Yeah, well, yes, it depends. I mean, again, this is where it's helpful. Now, we may both agree that you're really low in something. Okay, yeah, I don't have as much confidence because, yep, I knew about that. That doesn't change that, yeah, I don't have a lot of confidence. Or that, and this is where we both agree, yep, Julius, I have a really high view of how you, and if that reconciles how you see yourself, great. If I see you much higher than you see yourself, that may be, if it's in areas like integrity and intent, that's more plausible, and that I may not have as much insight into that, literally be able to see inside you, but it's certainly something for you to look at and say, gosh, am I as clear in my intent and in my integrity as I want to be? When others see us much lower than we see ourselves, that can be what I heard someone call once the major ego enema, where you kind of go, oh, gosh, you know, and that's true for, and what I'm describing are pretty accurate for most 360 tools anyway. What's a bit different about around trust is that people tend to take it more personally. It's more of, gosh, I'm not a good person, or I'm a bad person.
Mm.
And that's the thing to be sensitive to. So that's the one we've got on the website is more of just, hey, take your temperature, get some feedback from people. Mm-hmm. It's more of a, and I don't mean to minimize this or say that it doesn't have any validity. It's just more of a marketing intrigue, you know, it's a hook type of thing. Go, you know,
right.
Part of our goal is to get people intrigued where they go, boy, this is really, I'd like to bring this into my organization. I'd like to teach this myself. I, you know, it's that kind of thing. And then we've got more robust tools if that's the case. This one's more of just take the temperature. We go, ooh, I like this. Or for some people, it's sufficient. They go, huh, all this stuff's bogus anyway. How can I go do terrible things to people? You know, so
mm-hmm.
I'm teasing. So
I gotcha.
Good. Good question, Julius.
Deborah, did we answer your question about where integrity fits into this?
Deborah, go ahead.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I want to say this. I want to be really, really clear, because the reason I tend to emphasize confidence is that for most of us, integrity is what we already think of. And so it's like, I don't need to go there, because and what I don't want people to think is that we think integrity is unimportant. To me, it's absolutely essential. And if I have integrity, I'm going to deliver on my commitments. I'm going to be somebody that can be trusted, or I'm going to, you know, go do something different in terms of the line of work I'm in or something. I may not be well suited to it. And I've done that literally, you know, things I got into going, you know what, I'm really better at something else, and that's where my gifts lie, and I need to be true to that and get off the track that I'm on.
Well, we've got about 10 more minutes left, and it looks like there's a few more people that might have questions. Is there anybody with a question for Barry?
Hey, Papa.
Who's this? Oh, there might be some folks that have not muted yet. So if you're not muted, just hit star 6, and we'll keep the line quiet. So, Barry, can you share what can happen in organizations that you've already worked with? What are some transformations that have happened, and how long does it take? Like, let's say that someone takes one of these assessments that you offer, and they realize, wow, trust is really low. And you know, how fast can things turn around?
Well,
and what happens when they do?
The title of our book is The Speed of Trust, which is kind of you know, for a lot of us, because most of us think developing trust takes a long time.
And right.
You can lose it really quickly. We all know that. You can actually develop trust really quickly as well. If we think about our own behavior, I mean, I travel somewhere, usually on a plane, almost every week, and I put my life in the hands of a couple of people I have not and probably never will meet, and we call them pilots.
Right.
You know, we just assume they're competent and that they're not out to wreck the plane or take us all down together. So, and we do that with emergency rooms. We do it all kinds of services and things, and some of them literally put our life in the hands of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Or may do that. That's part of what we do is, you know, if we're in healthcare, et cetera. So part of our message is that, you know, when you get trust, you increase trust, your speed tends to go up, and speed has all kinds of wonderful benefits to it. It's not the whole world's like, the world's going fast enough, you know, let me off, but I want to be, you know, there's a lot of times we spend way too much time working on stuff, managing relationships versus getting work done.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I don't want to get too far off on that. What was the question how fast can you transform an organization? Here's what I've seen. Somewhere, you know, the old rules of thumb I've heard for years, and a lot of my background is in OD, whether development or design of orgs, is that, you know, 5 to 7 years is what you can expect in an organizational, you know, major organizational change. I have seen things that our clients are reporting to us. You know, I've seen literally a senior leadership teams of a major, major organization transform in 2 or 3 days, you know, the time we spent together.
Really?
Really. I have seen. Now, again,
when
it's not
you
like,
say transform,
I
like,
mean
what
relationships,
would
people walking in, distrusting, ready to bail, leave the organization. I mean, just where you go like, wow, I hope we can maintain some order. I'm not looking for breakthrough in this group, and to have that transform in a couple of days. Right. Now, just like other things, it's not like it just is what we do in the 2 days. A lot of times we work with groups, we'll do pre-work. You know, there's surveys, there's interviewing, sometimes face-to-face. Especially when I've got a very difficult senior-level group, we'll do quite a bit of prep work for the time we actually spend together face-to-face as a group. I found that, but again, I've seen that happen and had them report back that the results, when they got back to work, people are like, what happened to you? What's, you know, this is amazing. So, and part of it's the common language. I mean, I do team building, and that's how you and I got connected originally, Tom, was through Teach Me Teamwork. And there's a lot to be said for just getting people to connect on a human level, you know, and just be able to solve problems, work through things, get them out of their typical roles. But I've seen some, you know, I don't want to get too far into, you know, these fantastic results and things. We have one publicly traded company that's pretty large, and one of their people says, fairly senior person, not a senior executive, but fairly high up, say, our stock went up 80% last year due to trust. And it's like, we're not going to claim all that increase. It's not like the only thing they're working on is going, wow, you know, it's like Charles Atlas or something. You know, we used to get kicked around the beach, get sand in our eyes. We were these little wimps, but then Covey came in and we got trust, and now, you know. But, again, you've seen this, I'm sure, with team building or individual coaching, that when an organization has readiness, and there's usually a lot of things to prepare for that, and a lot of it's timing. You come in with something, and what I start off, especially with teams, is that we'll start off as if it's a workshop, and all we're going to do is stay in the workbooks and show movies and talk about things. Uh-huh. But I'm constantly looking for opportunities to talk about what's really going on. And once that happens, we get off the set workbook agenda and get really into talking about their issues. And with a language, a common language, we find that people are able to air out a lot of things they've needed to, and they apply these 13 behaviors we've identified that are very commonsensical. And then they get, and people say, boy, that was really, really helpful. So, and by the way, I use things from Teach Me Teamwork, just a little commercial there, but I will bring things in that aren't part of the set CoveyLink curriculum to be able to shift up things with a group and get them into a different openness. So that's
which
been
is
a
what
wonderful
I,
thing.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that we first met each other, and you absolutely get that to really move into this material on trust, you've got to there's got to be an experience of it. If it's just all in your head and reading a book, it's not as effective.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have a question for Barry at this point?
Tom, it's Sandra.
Yes,
Barry, yes, I do have a question, if you don't mind.
Don't mind at all.
Okay. I work in an organization where we're just going through a major restructure right now, and I'm moving into a new division. Which means it's new, some new senior management positions that are moving into the same division. And along with that, there's some new people that I haven't worked with before and new work. And so we're all just right now forming this new division and learning what each other is responsible for and how they work and all those good things. There have been a few, quite a few areas throughout this whole program that Tom is running that I've had aha moments, you know, and this is definitely one of them. And there are, with these new people and the old people coming from our old division in new roles, I'm finding that I'm having to work on building a lot of trust with these people all over again. And it's so I've worked here for 10 years, so some of these people I've worked with for quite a number of years, and they know me. And, you know, they know how I operate. They know how I can deliver, but some of these people don't. And I'm wondering if there is a best practices approach to building trust with these new people with the focus areas that you have identified as results, capabilities, intent, and integrity, or is this, like, what is the best approach when working with new people or working with people that I have in the past who are now in new roles?
Okay. So, Sandra, let me make sure I understand this. You've got people you've known for a long time, some of them who are moving into a new role in this team, and you've got some new people from outside of this group, maybe even outside the organization coming in. Is that right?
That's right. Along with that, my direct boss, it changed on January 1 of this year, so I've been working since then building the trust and the confidence that he, for him and in my own abilities and my own capabilities. So it's everybody pretty much on the new team.
Yeah, so here's a few thoughts, and I'm not sure, when you say the right approach, I look for multiple right answers. You know, I can give you three different options and, this is a good one, this worked. Here's a few elements I'd look at. One is to look at you individually, Sandra, because you're the only person you can control, and say, what can you do to continue to increase the trust level with the person you report into? That's an important relationship. Make sure, particularly if he or she's the sponsor of all this, that they're not just comfortable, but really have clarity about what you're doing and why with them, with the team. So I'd work on myself. I always work on myself. And those four cores that I mentioned are really focusing on ourselves. And then we look at in our relationships, we've got 13 behaviors. So I won't list them all. I've been referencing a few of them through our conversations. But it literally would behave in such a way that's very congruent with who I am, that make it easier for people to trust us. Some other tools I'd look at in working with a team like this, part of the reason we wrote the book we realized we're not going to work with every organization out there. Some are too small, some from a budget standpoint. It's just one of the ways most everybody can get a book. And so there are organizations, they just have almost a reading club that people read the book and sometimes pass it around, but that's a way to get at least some of the shared knowledge to people. I think what's even better, in addition, as a replacement for, I think having meetings together and, training, I would look at that way, but having a workshop where people can go through and learn these concepts together, and especially the mixed team. I just spent last week with a team that was a senior leadership team that in the last year, half of them have been hired in the organization. It's a very fast growth company. And having a shared experience and shared language together just accelerates the hopefully this forming process and even norming. So I think there's places for all that, and part of it's just budget and timing. But just to circle back, I think it's giving both the person you report to your peers, if you're part of this team or if you're just serving this team, being able to give them someone they can trust and then being able to give them a common language. And how you can do that is through, copies of the book can help. There are things on our website, like Julius has referenced. And then if you can put on a workshop or something like that, that can be a really good solution. So beyond that, there's additional things when you get into systems design, et cetera, kind of through the lens of trust that are really helpful. But, again, I kind of go a first things first approach.
Okay. Is that helpful? Thank you very much.
Barry, I was just speaking with an organization that had contacted me and was asking me questions about how to design a staff retreat for 14 senior managers. Mm-hmm. And a year ago, to give you an example, I asked them what they've been doing, and they said, well, last year we read The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And I said, so what happened after that? And, what did you do with that information? Nothing. Mm-hmm. They just read the book, assuming that reading the book together would somehow change things. And that it didn't work. Reading the book together and not doing anything with the information doesn't move you forward. In fact, and what I was suggesting is that it can turn into a flavor of the month club, unless we really begin to say we're going to move beyond just talking about it a book.
Yeah, as my experience as a language instructor, there's really three phases of language development. How do we develop language? The first is in familiarity. Most of us have this experience in school where you took Latin or French or Spanish or German or Japanese, something like that, when you went through school, if you weren't raised with another language in addition to English, is that you get familiar. So you learn some phrases, you learn some vocabulary, a little bit of grammar, but you really can't carry on a conversation if people get off script with you. So if they get beyond the bonjour, qui ça va, you're stuck. The second phase is called conversation, and there's a range in each of these, but conversation can go anywhere from you can basically understand what people are saying, particularly if they speak slowly to you and don't use, if it's like they're talking to a little kid, and because that's usually the only level you can converse on, all the way up to where you're fairly conversational. Then third phase is fluency, where literally you think in that language, you dream in that language, you almost breathe it. And that's where my French is like. I'm not native, and I don't think I ever will be. But my French is really quite good. I do Speed of Trust training in French, and it seems to go over well. And so it's the same thing here, is that helping people develop conversation. If you give people a book to read, then I'd be amazed they got past familiarity. They may recognize the five dysfunctions, for example, but do they, you know, conversations where we really start to take this language and speak it and back and forth and mm-hmm. see, hey, look, we're getting into, you know, one of these dysfunctions, for example. Mm-hmm. Fluency is where you really start, you stop thinking about, you know, I say, what's the best outcome, the speed of trust? Over time, you don't, we have cards and other things, you don't even refer to them. You operate in a whole different level, and it's become part of your modus operandi as a team, is that, mm-hmm. you know, that was really useful, it's gotten us this far, and trust is really a hallmark of how we operate together, and this was a useful tool to get us here. You know, we still got, you know, and hopefully there's other things down the road beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And when I suggest to folks that if there's one thing they should invest their time and energy in, it's trust. And the subtitle of your book is, unless it's changed, is the one thing that changes everything.
Why would we change that? That's right. I kept that.
Well,
going to Lencioni's work, you know, the first dysfunction is an absence of trust.
In his little diagram, there's a mm-hmm. pyramid, and mm-hmm. the base of the pyramid is the absence of trust.
Yep.
And so, when I talk to people about the same way that you do about how do we build teams, well, you want to have a common language and a system to communicate what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, and that's why I like the five dysfunctions. And then they get into trust. And that's where if trust is the foundation of everything that you're going to be building on, the number one dysfunction, the book to get is The Speed of Trust, which is why I'm excited to have you on here today.
And by the way, I do think, and I've just recently been into the five dysfunctions much deeper than I had been before, I do believe Speed of Trust addresses the other four dysfunctions as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that there are, that's why I'm excited about this material. So, Barry,
tell our listening audience.
Our listening audience today. Can you share with people what the next step for them could be? That we've talked about getting the book. Can you identify the website for us?
Sure. It's CoveyLink, C-O-V as in victory, E-Y-L-I-N-K.com. So www.coveylink.com. And there's all kinds of different resources and kind of next steps listed on there. At a minimum, I encourage people to get a copy of the book. You can get that either through us, but Amazon's a great place, wherever you know, any great bookseller will carry it. Mm-hmm. But get a copy of the book, read through it, see if it's something that rings true for you. And again, I would encourage you to apply it. You know, not just like, oh, good book, I like this. I can think of several people who need this. But really in ourselves, in our own work, is saying, what can I do as a manager, as coach, to be, you know, a trusted manager, as coach, or a manager's trusted coach and trusting coach? And mm-hmm. so I think the book's a great place to start. If people are interested enough where they say, boy, I've got a team I'm part of, or, you know, CoveyLink, I go on site regularly working with organizations, and you can contact us through our website, or you can contact me directly at Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, at CoveyLink.com. And it doesn't have to be... If you don't want a workshop, that's not a problem. If you just have a question, I'm glad to respond. We even certify people to get trained to be able to deliver this in their organization. So they usually come to a public workshop. Most of those are here in Utah, where I'm based. And then they go to a two-day workshop, then they do a one-day train-the-trainer. And, again, if they've got the facilitation skills, they're able to turn around and start delivering that in their organization. So those are all good next steps.
Yeah.
But Stephen comes out, you know, if you've got a big organization, we have Stephen come speak. We certainly do that all the time, or I can speak. So there's multiple ways to work with us. But, again, our whole commitment and mission is around how do we increase trust in the world and not just, you know, we believe if you start with individuals, you're working with teams and move into organizations. The fifth wave of trust is societal trust. How do we create a world that works for everyone, that's high trust? That's our mission as an organization. That's what we're fundamentally about. So.
And the application of this, and we didn't get into this really, is family, business, governments, you name it, these principles apply in one-on-one relationships. It all applies, and that's one of the other great, great pieces of this work, in my estimation, is that learn it and apply it in your business, and learn it and apply it in the relationship that you have with your son, which is... You know, my great teachers are my daughter and son, and so I want to thank you, Barry, for joining us today.
Absolutely, it's just a pleasure. Again, I think what I really want to commend everybody in this program who's working on being a manager as coach, as you and I have talked about this, Tom, and the leadership you're providing here. I think it's just an outstanding investment for your organizations and particularly for yourselves to make in yourself and in your organization of giving people someone who's more competent, who's more committed, who's clearer on what it means to lead and how to do that from a coaching approach and to make a difference in organizations to use your gifts and talents, what you're really about. So I want to just commend all of you for doing that.
Yes, here, here. And we're in the week 9 of a 10-week program, so it's a delight to have you at the very end. It's like dessert, Barry.
Wow. Less filling. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Fewer calories.
That's right. Yeah, lightweight. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, as we wrap up here, I see we've gone a little bit over our 60-minute period here, but I'm curious if anybody would like to share what that you got out of this call today, something that would be useful for Barry to know, what was beneficial for you. You might have to hit your *6 key. There are a few people who'd like to get in on the end here.
Tom, it's Julius.
Yes, Julius.
I just think it really has reinforced for me the importance of trust. I know we have a lot of issues in our organization, and I plan on getting, we've got two departments that came together, so that is, and they were two departments, research and engineering. There was a lot of fighting back and forth, infighting, and I think this may be a good way of getting a common language to help bring the culture together a little more quickly.
The culture piece is great. Yes, thank you, Julius. Barry, thanks again for joining us on this Manager's Coach Bootcamp special session call.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Well, again, for those of you who are listening to the recording here, we've been speaking with Barry Relaford, who works at CoveyLink. He is the lead trainer there of the Leading at the Speed of Trust workshop. He is, you'll see his name mentioned in the Speed of Trust book by Stephen M. R. Covey, which is available at Amazon and many other locations. So get the book, read that book. It's also available in audio. I highly recommend it. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. I look forward to seeing you on a future call. Bye-bye.